There's just 2 weeks left in the regular session, but lawmakers may stay longer looking for consensus on how to lessen the gap between spending and revenue. Millions of dollars have been cut from the state's budget, and some lawmakers want millions more cut before they will agree to other types of revenue generation, such as an income tax or sales tax. How have the cuts that have been made so far to state government impacted communities across the state? We'll ask today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Where is the sweet spot when it comes to the size of state government? How much can and should lawmakers and the governor trim to ensure that state services continue to run effectively and efficiently without dragging down other sectors of the economy? House lawmakers passed a budget with $32 million in reductions. The governor's proposed budget cut $60 million, and the Senate Finance Committee released a plan to cut $337 million. These are dizzying numbers, big differences, and not much consensus. Here to discuss the impacts of cuts that have already been made and proposals for more are Kathy Wasserman, the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, joining us from the studios of KTOO in Juneau. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
And also in the studio with me is Jonathan King. Jonathan is the vice president and senior economist with Northern Economics in Anchorage. Hello.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. You, Alaskans, can also join the discussion if you have comments or questions or observations about state cuts in your community. Give us a call at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255 statewide. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. Kathy, how many communities does the Alaska Municipal League represent?
165 as of last February when we had one new city join the list.
All right.
And that's all of them. That's every organized city and borough in the state.
Oh, interesting. So do you advocate for certain ideas, such as yes to some cuts and revenue ideas, but no to others? Or how do you get the collective message of AML communities to lawmakers?
Well, just like any group of people, that's not an easy process. But we are in contact with all the municipalities through email throughout the entire year. And then we have four public meetings a year where we come together, we break out into groups, we discuss the issues, we come together, we craft the language, and then we vote on it. And then we proceed on for the session with the issues that have been voted on by the municipalities.
That must be quite an effort to get consensus on these issues with 165 communities. How long do you have these meetings? How hard is the work?
It's a bit difficult, not so much because there's 165, but because the communities are so different. We represent Anchorage with 350,000, and we represent Bettles, the city of Bettles, with, I think, 11. So really their issues are the same, but sometimes their view of it is different. And so that's a bit difficult, but we don't advocate for anything that will pit money from one community against another. We don't advocate for projects. We only advocate for policy changes that will either impact municipalities in a beneficial way or will hurt them in a detrimental way.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing budget cuts and local economies and the impacts that are rippling out across the state from cuts to state services and what the future may look like with more cuts. Kathy Wasserman with the Alaska Municipal League, the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, is with us from the KTOO studios in Juneau. And Jonathan King, senior economist with Northern Economics, is here in Anchorage in our studio. Jonathan, in January, you gave some bleak pronouncements to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee about the economy, calling it our Great Recession, and stating that you expect to lose 6% of our jobs. Now it's April. Lawmakers have been chipping away at our deficit problem. What are your thoughts today?
Well, I think, broadly, our thoughts about the trajectory of the economy haven't changed. It's only been a couple of months. To recap, we lost 8,000 to 10,000 jobs here in the state last year, roughly 2%. We're expecting similar, perhaps maybe slightly smaller losses in this upcoming year. And those are largely losses that are associated with changes that have already taken place in the economy. They're associated with past spending reductions with the oil industry, past cuts to state government. And so the real question is, we definitely have one more year in recession going forward. And now the question is, how many more years will we be in recession, and what does that look like? And a lot of that has to do with the decisions that are made in Juneau in this upcoming session, should they come to some agreement or long-term fiscal plan. But that's really what we're thinking is, what does this next phase of the recession look like, and how long does it last?
And how about directly? How has the recession, the slowdown in the economy, and the uncertainty over spending, how is that impacting your business specifically? Are you seeing a big slowdown yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. We are seeing a big slowdown. We belong to what's called the professional and business services sector. And, right along with oil and gas, construction, and state government itself, we're one of the largest sectors in terms of job losses. Our sector's probably on a rate to lose 7 to 8% of the jobs that it had. That's about what we were losing last year. We're kind of in that zone again this year. We're definitely feeling it with it. At Northern Economics, we have a broad range of clients, both public and private, and they're both very reticent to spend money at this point because they just don't know what the future looks like. And I think it's important to acknowledge that state cuts have already affected the economy, that it's not will state cuts affect the economy, it's that has already happened and what does it look like continuing going forward. So, we expect another couple rough years unless we get more money flowing in the economy. And the big drivers for money flowing in the economy, at least broadly across the state, are state spending and oil and gas industry spending, and then all of the money that comes out of that. The federal government also plays a role, and we are facing some really significant uncertain times, particularly with the new administration's budget. So it's a very complex time to be thinking about what does the future of the state of Alaska look like.
It's sort of the 1-2 economic punch, isn't it? State cuts and federal cuts that are coming this way.
Yeah, I would almost go with 1-2-3, with one being the oil industry slowing down its spending, then the associated reductions associated with, with state spending, which we've seen, that's continuing to flow through the pipeline. We're not done necessarily with those cuts yet. And then on top of that, while the Trump administration might make resource development easier here in Alaska, we have a significant federal component here through defense, the National Park Service, EPA, BLM, the Bureau of Labor and Bureau of Land Management. So those cuts to those departments will be felt as well. And many of those National Park Service and Bureau of Land Management employees, they live and commute to rural Alaska. And so those cuts will be felt, just beyond the urban core. They'll be felt across the state.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call statewide if you'd like to join our conversation. Have you seen cuts to services in your community? Do you think that more should be done? Has the government cut enough in the state, out of the state budget? Or how are these impacts being felt in your community? 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 550-8422. 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Kathy, let's get your general assessment based on what you're hearing from community leadership across the state about budget cuts, and then we'll look more closely at specific areas. But what's been the conversation in this past 6 months or so, Kathy, with community leaders about how budget cuts are impacting them?
Well, I think, first of all, before you even get to the budget cuts themselves, the disruption of not knowing what's coming out of the legislative process. We all depend on revenue sharing, and we never know from year to year if it's coming, if it's going to get cut, if it's going to get sliced. And so the budgets are due into the state before we usually know what we're getting. And that's very difficult to plan. And the last number of years, the cities have turned in their budgets, then only to find that either, like, for instance, last year, school bond debt reimbursement was cut. And so then you've got to plug that hole. And that's not always easy. Well, it's never easy to do because they were fairly large holes. And so everyone ends up scrambling at the end. Schools end up doing the same thing. Pink slip teachers, and then hire them back. Who wants to come to Alaska to become a teacher where you may get pink slipped and then you may get hired back? I mean, our process just doesn't allow for easy, smooth transitions.
You know, something you said about the disruption within the legislative process. Before I want to talk about specific cuts, especially to schools and some other things, but just that idea of this uncertainty that's going on right now. Jonathan, from an economist standpoint, you talked a little bit about the slowdown in business, but what kind of effect does that have on the potential for investments from others, or the idea of new businesses and sort of the things that help boost the economy when there is this disruption and this uncertainty that's playing out through the legislative actions that are being taken and some that are not? How does that change things? Is there any way to really gauge that?
It is a very difficult thing for us to gauge, because you're trying to assess something that didn't happen. And it's kind of a what for question. But I think one of the things that we're consistently hearing is that people are very reticent to make those investments. And I think it goes beyond perhaps the you know, kind of attracting a new employer. It even applies to businesses that are already here and really, you know, filters down through the economy. If you're in an area where you're not getting state trooper service that you used to be getting, and your crime rate is going up, you know, that affects home values. It affects the desirability of the area for investment. If you live in Bristol Bay and you're a Bristol Bay permit holder, and ADF&G, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, has to cut area biologists or counting towers, and now all of a sudden has to manage run stocks more conservatively, that means that your harvest level is going to be smaller. It means lower fish taxes. It means lower revenues. And if you're a permit holder, it could affect your decision whether or not you're on the water, whether or not you invest in a new boat or a refrigerated seawater system. So that level of uncertainty and the inability to the difficulty of adapting to a continued and constant state of uncertainty, it reflects itself across the entire state, from that municipal level and that corporate level, all the way down to the decisions of, you know, individual small business owners and you know, permit holders in fishing areas.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation about state budget cuts and how they are impacting local economies. 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The Senate Finance Committee yesterday proposed nearly $70 million in cuts to the base student allocation for schools, dropping it by about $300 per student. The Senate plan would finance faster internet service for schools, enhance online education, eliminate the Alaska Performance Scholarship Program that Governor Parnell put in place, and would let school districts suspend review of curriculum for an unspecified time. In place of the scholarship program, grants for innovation would be made available to schools. Kathy, this was just put forward yesterday, but are you hearing from communities and school district leaders about what this proposal would mean for them in the next school year?
Well, all the new programs that the Senate talked about, the grant program, the broadband expansion, those don't really have as much weight as the fact that money was taken out of the BSA. That's what's got everyone concerned. And perhaps you'll get the money back through the grant. Perhaps not. Perhaps you'll get the money back through broadband expansion, if you even have enough money to have broadband and thus the expansion. I mean, the BSA cut is in itself very, I think, pretty serious and a bit sad that that's the route we're going to take to balance the budget. They said, well, it doesn't, the extra money doesn't mean that students necessarily are more successful. No, it probably doesn't, but I think it probably certainly helps to nudge those students towards better success. Certainly, getting poorer doesn't accomplish much, and I think probably they should have taken a better look at that. But that was their choice, and I think that's obviously the direction that the Senate's been on. So we'll just have to wait till the end of the session to see how all of this comes out when it gets to conference.
Jonathan, your thoughts on both the viability of this shift in funding and how it could impact the future of education in the state?
Well, I think the conversation around education is extraordinarily difficult. And, you know, one of the, I think Kathy said it, you know, said it very well, in that there isn't a lot of data which suggests that spending more, particularly in our rural communities, has resulted in a better educational product. That being said, if you're spending less, it doesn't seem to be necessarily a way to a better educational product.
That's exactly what Republican Senator Shelley Hughes of Palmer says about the funding the innovation grants rather than scholarships. She says it will allow school districts to do more with less.
Well, what they're trying to do is, if we look at staffing ratios, particularly out in rural Alaska, the staffing ratios for the number of teachers and the number of support staff that we have, per student or per 100 students is much higher than what we have in urban areas. And so the idea here, I think, is that this idea that if you push people to online education, that perhaps we'll end up with a better product. It's somewhat of an unsupported idea, I guess, at this point. But one thing that you will know is that from an urban or from a rural economic perspective is that if you are spending less on people, and this is separate from the education issue, if you're spending less on people, then you're going to have higher unemployment in those communities. So what we're really talking about here is functionally what will turn into a job cuts, in particularly in rural communities, because the staffing ratios are higher in rural communities. So we've got a couple different arguments going on here. We've got how do we get our education system to perform better, particularly in some of the more off-road system areas. It's very difficult to produce the educational results that we want to see. And at the same time, there is this economic argument, right? There's this what is really a fiscal argument, which is we want to spend less. And, is that actually going to result in a better educational product. And so there's a lot going on that's embedded in these cuts, and there's a lot of different arguments that are going on that are really kind of going unsaid at the moment. If you go and read the papers, it's a bigger, broader philosophical argument.
This is Talk of Alaska. If you're just joining us, we are discussing today state budget cuts and the future of more cuts and how these are already impacting local economies and what that might look like going forward. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org.
Can I say one thing about also the comments at the press availability? I guess I was sort of taken aback when, instead of saying we're all going to have to knuckle down and get through this and make a success of it, instead we heard we are going to allow you to do more with less. Like we're all going to stand up and go, wow, yay, this is our lucky day. It just seemed a little bit wacko.
All right. House leaders had proposed cutting $50 million from school construction assistance. Then that idea got ditched, at least for now. Kathy, this kind of combines with an email question that we had from Willie Dunn, who wanted to ask about the cost shifting to municipalities and how that may impact taxation, local taxation. How dependent are, this is probably a silly question to ask, are communities on state dollars when it comes to school construction and maintenance? If these cuts come back, what would it mean for local school districts? How would they have to make that money up? And would communities be able to support that level of increase in local taxes?
Communities only have two ways to make money. That's either through fees, like harbor fees, trash fees, and through taxes. So any additional money they might have, they have to either get through taxes or through cuts to services. And the services at most municipalities are a bit more basic than obviously the state. You know, it means plowing your road, having your city hall open for elections and other business, including most of your utilities and those kind of processes. So they either have to cut those services or raise taxes. That's basically the only two directions to go. So any cost shifting through school maintenance, deferred maintenance, is going to have to be made up in one of those two ways. And, of course, the construction is so expensive that only in the larger communities are they going to be able to really look at that. Smaller communities, of course, that's out of the question.
There's just not enough numbers of individuals living there to get enough income from. Jonathan, you wanted to add in?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we're also seeing out of the legislature is a bit of mixed messaging. One of the goals of these municipalities desires for the state is for the municipalities to be able to stand on their own and to be able to have robust economies and be able to have. We call it, when we talk with our clients that are municipal clients, we talk about it as playing to their strengths, whether that be fish processing and raw fish taxes or sales taxes or property taxes or hotel, motel, bed taxes, all that sort of stuff. Every municipality has to play to its strengths with regard to revenue generation. And one of the things that unfortunately that we've seen is that the revenue pressure is so high, the cost-cutting pressure and the budget deficit pressure is so high in Juneau, is that when municipalities make positive change and are working towards having more revenue to strengthen their own their own ability to adapt, one of the things that we've seen in this session is the legislature turns around and says, aha, you've found new money. We can cut your supply of money here. And so that kind of goes against the long-term desire that we have of building sustainable municipal governments that are able to self-tax and self-regulate and stand on their own two feet. And I think it just goes to talk to the depth of the pressures that people are feeling at the state level and then are thus being reflected down onto the municipal level with this cost shifting that's going on.
So it's almost as if it's a punitive reaction if they come up with some innovative ideas for generating new revenue, then they see a bad result on the other side from the state.
Yeah, and I can't talk about specifics, but you know, I saw this legislative session where we were working with a municipality. They were making significant progress forward and improving their own fortunes, and immediately in Juneau there was a desire to reduce their income or change the structure so that they would have been, and this actually has to do with school reimbursement, they would have been punitively impacted for making a positive step forward. And I think that that's a really difficult place for municipalities to be in because, you know, as a local leader, you're supposed to be working towards strengthening your community. But if the state is going to look at your efforts to strengthen your community as an opportunity to shift costs down on top of you, that puts municipalities in an extraordinarily difficult position.
Right. It would kind of impact innovation, it would seem. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Roger is in White Mountain. Hi, Roger.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
As the funding from both the federal government and state are inevitable, no one will know until both federal and state budgets are passed, state real soon, hopefully, and federal before the end of the year. In your forecasting, which programs are going to be impacted the most and where in the state? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Roger. That's a little bit of, that would be difficult to project because there's so much that's unknown, but give it a good shot, Jonathan.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Ubla Lotuk, Roger, good morning. It's great to hear you. I think as we look at the states, budget situation and really what's left in the budget, you know, we've seen some of the smaller departments, Department of Labor, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, transportation, we've seen cuts in those areas, and we're still continuing to see cuts in those areas, but the dollar value goes down every year in terms of what's left to cut. The two big places that the state has left to cut are K-12 education and health and social services, largely the Medicaid budget. And, you know, I think you can think about those as having a disproportionate impact on rural Alaska and the places where state cuts are most likely to be felt, because most communities have a school. Maybe they don't have a seasonal fish watchtower or anybody permanently stationed at the airport to do maintenance on the airport, but they very likely have a school. And so I think as we talk about this discussion going forward, that, you know, the cuts to education and then the cuts or the reformulation of the Medicaid program, those are where you're going to feel it in rural communities. With the federal budget, we just don't know yet. Presidential budgets never survive their first contact with the enemy, as they say. And we don't know if we're going to end up seeing another year of, continuing resolution, which means, kind of flat funding of the current structure, or if we're going to see some real cuts to programs that affect Alaskans and the management of federal lands here in Alaska.
All right. We are talking about budget cuts and local economies and the impacts of what future cuts could mean across the state. This is Talk of Alaska. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll have more discussion about budget cuts and take your questions.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing budget cuts and the impacts to local economies across the state. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-478-8255. Statewide, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The university system would see additional cuts under the revised Senate finance budget plan released yesterday. Another $5.7 million, according to a release from UA President Jim Johnson, for a total of $22 million in cuts. The president, President Johnson called the cuts devastating. Kathy Wasserman is with us, head of the Alaska Municipal League. She's in Juneau. Kathy, as the UA system reduces satellite offices in communities, what happens? What are our communities within the Municipal League dealing with as these UA services get winnowed down?
Well, to be truthful, Lori, I don't keep my eye on that sort of thing too much. I'm so busy on just the basic needs of the municipality in order to operate efficiently, effectively, that I don't usually get into those sorts of cuts.
Okay.
Of course, they'll have an impact perhaps on jobs or the readiness of some of those people to do whatever it is they choose to do. And that's an issue throughout all the communities, whether it's university or K-12. But I don't know what they're specifically going to do or what type of cuts will be realized with this newest slash.
Jonathan, give us your thoughts on sort of the long view for how this could impact Alaska's workforce in the future. UA President Johnson says the Senate's budget proposal would mean $75 million, nearly 20% reduction over 4 years. And he also mentioned that the loss of the Performance Scholarship Program would mean another $10 million lost out of the UA system. What do you think this will do for the future of education here?
Well, I think it makes it very difficult for us to attract and retain some of, you know, the best students, and also to give educational opportunities to students who might otherwise not have had the ability, maybe don't have the ability to go outside. You know, we have a relatively small college system with regard to options. I mean, for one state, the number of choices that you have in state is relatively small. And, you know, clearly this makes it harder to to reach out to students. And to go to the question you asked Kathy is, we can do a lot with distance education, but there are times when boots on the ground make a huge difference. And I think one of those places is, retraining, is attracting those students from rural communities who might not otherwise make it into the system. You know, if you have an office that's there, that's in your town, you can identify that. You can identify with that as a source of pride. You can say that somebody's gone there and they're taking classes and that I'm taking classes there. Once you go to online, you can go to any online vendor that's anywhere. You could take classes from Johns Hopkins. You could take classes from Harvard. There's lots of places that you can take classes from. And I think it becomes more difficult for us to make the case about the university system when all of a sudden now you are competing, you know, much more broadly. The university system, if they're subject to continued cuts, and we do have to remember that they've gone from a $500 million budget down to like a $350 or $330 million budget. I'm going to apologize for not being able to nail those exactly on the head. That the university system is going to have to figure out what it does well, and it's going to have to execute and do that well. And basically what we're seeing is a path towards a less diverse, less robust university system that is going to have to be very focused on producing specific, producing workers for specific industries. And then we're going to see, you know, kids either not going to school, not getting that technical education, or losing some students that might be attracted to, you know, programs that the university can't provide, seeing them attracted outside.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go back to the phones for a moment now. Bob is in Anchorage. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Important topic, kind of depressing, I guess, because anything you do has negative multipliers. Good job in covering the topic again, though. I just wanted to comment on the more with less. First of all, that's a cliche, I think. It's also nonsensical in the third year of major budget cuts to believe that anything you do is going to produce more results with less money. It's illogical as well, because you can produce more results with a given amount of money, or you can have a specified cut and reduce services. But we are so far beyond cutting fat into the bone, or maybe the femoral artery at this point. And I just think the Senate's approach is the wrong one. It's wrong-headed. We're getting the government that we're paying for, which is free, essentially, to individuals. And it's not well thought out. I think Alaskans would be willing to pay a reasonable amount toward the cost of government. You know, for the first time in our lifetimes, we can complain about that damn government, because we'll be helping to pay for it. As long as it's been free, it's been difficult to really get bothered by what's going on down there. But just the thought that the approach that the House and the governor are taking is much more well-reasoned than what the Senate did as recently as yesterday.
Well, thank you for the call, Bob. And, you know, he raises an interesting point. I've heard other people say similar things in reference to income taxes, for example, that if people have some of their own skin in the game, they're more likely to pay closer attention to what's going on and how money's being spent, rather than oil paying for everything and also, by the way, handing us a check every year. Jonathan, what are your thoughts about the differences in how a state that where people are more invested in their government, it differs from Alaska?
Well, I've had the opportunity to live in a bunch of different states, actually, in my adult lifetime, although I've been here in Alaska for almost the last 15 years. And there is a basic disconnect, I think, between, Alaskans don't necessarily realize what gets paid for basically on their behalf without them having to contribute anything. And I think in some ways it's impeded this discussion that, you know, ideally you'd like to see at the legislative level, where there is this discussion about what should government be doing and what should it be doing very, very well. That's really what we want, is we want some general agreement on what government should do, and then we want it to execute and do it very well. And instead, the approach we've taken have been these horizontal cuts, where the legislature has said, we're reducing your budget by 5%. You go and figure out what you're supposed to do. Well, you know, government agencies are charged with providing a host of services. They're not necessarily in the business of identifying what is a priority and then eliminating that. They get in trouble when they do take that approach. Usually they get called back to a legislature that says, that's not what we wanted you to do. And so, I think one of the things that we've really suffered through is that we haven't had the legislative leadership leadership that says, and the conversations really internally in Alaska that says, this is what we want to do and we want to do it well. One of the problems is that we can't fundamentally agree as Alaskans what we want government to do and what we want it to do it well, because we have such a broad array of views. And we haven't, not only have we not had that conversation, but clearly without that conversation, we haven't come to a conclusion. And it's gotten to the point where we are cutting bone in areas in places that are affecting public safety and the ability of people to earn money. Whereas if we took a more targeted approach, yes, we'd still have unhappy people, but we might be able to preserve the places where, you know, we need government to, you know, be performing its job.
And Kathy, I have a question specific for you that came in by email. But before we go to that, I want to get another call in here. Melody is in Anchorage. Hi, Melody.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Did you have a question?
I have a couple of comments. I'm the mother of a young man with Down syndrome, and now he has graduated. But I worry about what these education cuts will do to the special education, because they are often put at the bottom in the best of times. And when money gets tight, I worry about how they will be pushed all into one classroom and not receive the kind of services that they need. That's the first thing, and that's also tied with the second. I'm also a retired assistant professor, and I taught the last 5 years online. And I have a real problem with going to more distance classes. Not every student, and one of your people there brought this up, not every student can do online classes. They don't have the discipline, and they need that person in front of them. And by putting those into a more prominent position, you're hurting and taking away student choice, and you are definitely hurting the special education group, because they can't do classes online very well unless someone is sitting right with them. So I am appalled, absolutely appalled by our Senate. It feels to me as though they are saying, we really don't care about education. We don't want people educated. We certainly don't want a first-class university system, because that costs money, and we don't want to do that. And we don't want to educate our children. So you do more with less, which means 40 kids in the class and one teacher trying to do it. I guess I'd kind of like to know some of your thoughts about what else can we do besides, as I've done, called and written. I mean, I am stymied at this point. I don't feel like anybody listens. Thank you.
Thank you, Melody. You know, I appreciate the aspects that you brought up about this idea of more online education and things to consider, such as she raised, a young man with Down syndrome. How would this person be able to take classes online without appropriate assistance? These are the things that lawmakers need to hear, and others need to hear, that are possibly in support of certain ways of dealing with the budget deficit. Jonathan, did you have a thought on that?
Well, actually, what I was hoping is that we'd kick this to Kathy, because we don't interact with the legislature that much. In fact, this is the first year in the 35-year history of the company that we appeared before the legislature. So given that Kathy interacts with the legislature and tries to get them to pay attention, I want to hear how she thinks people should interact with the legislature.
Absolutely. Kathy, what else can people do? Melody sounded quite frustrated.
And, you know, I'm up there all the time, and believe me, I'm frustrated as well. So I don't know if I have the perfect silver bullet, but people just need to keep calling in, writing letters, testifying. I have found that you're better off to make yourself a pain in the neck. Sometimes people will do things just to get you out of their hair. And if that's what it takes to push what you think is right, then I go for it sometimes. I know sometimes they are so tired of hearing from me that I just barrage them. And I've had a couple of them comment to me when I get the mayors all riled up, call off the dogs. Well, if that's what it takes, says calling on the dogs, do it.
All right, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you want to call in with your comments or questions about budget cuts and local economies, in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Kyle in Kodiak sent in an email wanting to ask Kathy about the state's mandate for municipalities to provide senior and disabled vet property tax exemptions. He contends that when the law was passed, the state reimbursed the municipalities, then stopped. And he says there's a lot of disparity in that community, that some are struggling, some are not, and the system doesn't seem fair. Kathy, what's happening in that regard? Are municipalities supposed to take this up now?
Every community is mandated to property tax the first one value of $150,000 on every senior citizen in the state of Alaska and every disabled vet. That first $150,000 worth of their value on their primary home is exempted from property tax. Many years ago, when it was put into place, the state said, we're doing this for our seniors and our disabled vets. It's the right thing to do. Then a couple of years later, they didn't have enough money, and they said, well, we really can't reimburse you like we said we would, even though it's still on the books. But it's still the right thing to do, so hey, municipalities, you do it. So that, obviously, with the baby boomers, that exemption amount has been growing. I think in the municipality of Anchorage itself alone, it's almost up to $40 million a year. So all that exemption is taking place, and the state does not reimburse, yet cuts us in other places and mandates that we still do that exemption. I think most municipalities would do everything they could for their seniors, including perhaps keeping that exemption. But when it's mandated and a community has less and less money, and you've got people in your community that are very wealthy, that comes at an expense to the younger people starting out with families and their first jobs. So it's a difficult thing. We've tried to have that discussion with the legislators for many years, but it always sort of turns it goes in a different spot. They sort of look at us as trying to drive the seniors out, and that's not it at all. We just think that perhaps we should be able to have a say in how it operates. But we don't.
All right. Here is a question that came in by email specifically for Jonathan. James in Juneau says, Jonathan, have you calculated what the minimum state budget could be and still provide good law, order, required state services, etc.? And using that number, how much personal income tax would have to be collected from each working Alaskan to make that budget available? Hurry up, do some quick math.
The first rule of being a consultant is never do it on the fly, right? The first question is almost an impossible question, because what is good education, good public safety service, and what are you willing to pay for? I was talking with a friend this weekend who lives in one of the Turnagain communities that is going to vote in today's Anchorage municipal election. Reminder, everyone should go out and vote. About having the expansion of Anchorage Police Service or Emergency Response Service down into the Turnagain Arm communities. What people are willing to pay for varies from person to person and household to household.
Right, yeah.
I do think it's important
who decides what's the appropriate size of government service.
Exactly, and the quality of that government service. That being said, I think it's important to note that whatever the size of that government is, there's no way that you can provide it on an income tax alone. We do not have enough people here to fully fund the Alaska state government on the back of an income tax. And I think it's really important for people to realize that oil revenues will be part of the state's mix for the foreseeable future. I mean, certainly for the rest of my working lifetime and beyond that, we will have oil and mineral production here, and that will provide some level of base for our government. The question really is how do we get between the how do we get between what we think oil and gas will provide, knowing that oil and gas prices go up and down because it's a commodity, and what we need for a government that we can live with and provides provides services that help create an appropriate quality of life. And that's going to take a mix of income tax and other taxes. But I think it's really important to note that, one, you can't get there alone mm-hmm. on income taxes. And the income taxes that are being considered under the current House plan, they don't even try to do that. While there definitely will be a shock to Alaskans who've never paid an income tax relative to income taxes in the lower 48 and the many states that have income taxes, they're relatively modest income tax rates compared to other states, even though I will say that if that happens, we will feel it, right? So just some important points there, but a great and very challenging question.
Yes. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, more discussion on budget and local economies.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are talking about the state budget and local economies and cuts. I want to get to some more calls here quickly in our last few minutes. But first, I wanted to ask about the capital budget. It's under $100 million, about $96 million. It was $600 million in 2015 and $1.9 billion in 2013. So under $100 million now, almost $2 billion just a few years ago. As the projects that were funded in those past cashy years are completed, what does the construction season look like for this summer? And I think this is really a question for both of you. Kathy, I'm sure that you're hearing from municipalities about seasonal jobs, and there was an email question about labor cuts and part-time and seasonal workers. So what are you hearing about the concern over the potential of lack of jobs in construction this summer?
Well, I'm hearing more about the lack of the ability to rebuild failing infrastructure more than the jobs that it might generate. Of course, the jobs are very, very important, but the municipalities right now are thinking, what do we do with this infrastructure? The roads that are washed out, the schools that might be leaking roofs, the community halls that are falling apart, the water systems that are down, the electrical systems that are down. Those are there. And then, of course, the jobs to follow. And I usually those capital projects are a number of years behind. So a lot of the capital projects, you know, if you drive down some of the larger cities, you see road work being done. But, you know, give it a year or two, and those projects were usually generated in a capital budget 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So those are going to end really quickly. So it may look like, oh, we still must have money, we're doing projects. But those are going to end, and then we're really going to see a sharp decline in the infrastructure that's whole right now.
And that's kind of what I was alluding to, is the fact that a lot of these big projects are completing their, you know, last summer we saw the end of quite a number of them. I'm sure there will be some this summer, but not nearly as much. Jonathan, what are you hearing about these impacts?
I think Kathy really hit the nail on the head. You know, I mean, we are seeing the tailing off of the large fiscal budgets that we had for, you know, FY 13, 14, even into 15. The amount of unspent money that was allocated for projects is getting smaller and smaller. And, the current capital budget is really the minimum that's necessary for us to grab federal matches. And it's not enough to maintain the current infrastructure, let alone really start a whole bunch of new projects. So, we're going to be buoyed this summer a little bit by Alaska Airlines is making some pretty significant investment, and including in some rural communities for new hangars and stuff. And, you know, that's going to help soften the blow, some of that private sector investment. But we're not seeing the level of private sector investment than we were seeing a couple of years ago. So we are continuing on that downtrend with regard to these, major capital investment projects. And eventually that affects our ability to attract and retain, workers and businesses that maybe want to move here.
Let's get one more caller in. We've got a few callers on the line, but we're just about out of time. So let's get Jason in Juneau on the line. Hi, Jason. Do you have a quick question?
Hi. How's it going? Yeah, I had a question and then just a quick insight. My question is do you really think that they're going to be able to pass any substantial income tax that's going to help if they don't take the whole dividend? Because I know a lot of people, that's the thing. Nobody wants to vote for an income tax when there's some people that are going to get paid free money. I mean, they're not going to be adding to income tax and they'll be getting paid free money. So I think that's always been the hard selling point on that one. And another thing is there's no infrastructure plan to replace all this oil and gas industry. I mean, what are we all going to do? I mean, everybody wants to talk like the oil and gas is, that we want to all go to renewables and everything. That's fine. And then we're starting to feel like coal miners. What are we all going to do if there's no oil and gas industry? In other words, do we have another infrastructure plan in the works? Something to tap into a natural resource that we have here in this state, that we can use to help an industry, to get a leg up in industry? I guess that's my two questions.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much, Jason, for that. And that's kind of what I wanted to end on as well, is what do we do in the future? As an economist, Jonathan, I'll start with you, and then we'll get a quick comment from Kathy as well. When you consider the deficit and how fast the state could burn through savings, how quickly should reductions be made? Should lawmakers try to quickly cut hundreds of millions or take a much longer methodic approach? And then what needs to happen to avoid that seesaw effect of an economy that's so dependent on the whim of fossil fuel?
Well, I mean, that's the, $60 billion question right at this point,
yes.
Right? Is that, we are a commodity economy. We have no commodity that is as valuable as oil in its entirety. And, who knows if we'll ever find another one. We need to start thinking about going from this commodity production to really a fiscal management approach, right? We have banked this amount of money for this day, and we need to figure out how we're going to use that. Now, to the first question of, the PFD versus income tax, that's the great urban-rural divide. And
right.
That is going to be a challenge.
All right. Thank you, Jonathan King. Kathy, a couple last words here in our final seconds.
Well, personally, I don't think the Senate will ever agree to an income tax. They have said they do not believe in taxing the people of Alaska. However, with cost shifting, I think they're fine with municipalities doing that. So I'm not quite sure about that conundrum. And I think we need to have a plan. I think this is being done very piecemeal. And rather than looking at a whole plan of what's good for Alaska, there just seems to be concentration on the dollar value. And we just cut the dollar value without looking about where we want to go, what we want to be, and who we're going to affect.
And we have to leave it right there. Thanks so much to Kathy Wasserman with the Alaska Municipal League and Jonathan King with Northern Economics. This has been Talk of Alaska. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.